Okay, so welcome everyone to the Dallas Luster Swarm. I'm Rob Olson, and just tell us briefly, I'd like to tell you briefly about our organization. We're dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to DFW area. And we really appreciate everyone being out here tonight. We meet on the second and the fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. So we just follow sort of a university or a high school or a grade school year and don't meet in the summers. But we are planning a summer event, and more on that in just a second. If you haven't paid already, it is $5. You pay our treasurer, David Elkett, right here, if you inadvertently forgot to pay. Or it's $2 if you're a student. Any students here tonight? Okay, we got Daniel. You're a student. Where are you a student at? Christian College? Richland College. Okay, welcome. And so students can attend for $2. And if you want to become a subscriber, it's 6 months worth of lectures for $35. And then also, please, I want to remind everyone to pay for their food and drink as they leave. The waiter should bring your checks as soon as the presentation is over, if not beforehand. And so everyone's got a copy or are familiar with our spring schedule. So I'd like now to call up David Elkett. He's going to talk about our summer program. Any fans of Jeopardy out there? Any Jeopardy fans? Okay, well, we're going to have a summer Jeopardy program, and Dr. Elkett is spearheading that for us. So let me turn it over to David.
If anybody needs a copy of the schedule for the remainder of this thing, let me know. Ladies and gentlemen, and fans of the Philosopher's Forum, we're planning a summer program, which we were in the habit of doing every year, except last year we didn't get to. This year's the format's going to be Philosopher's Jeopardy, and we're going to have three schools, actually, the departments of philosophy, SMU, UTA, and UD will field a team, and they'll compete. And it's going to be on the SMU campus July the 22nd.
Tuesday.
It's a Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. And the exact place we'll let you know. We are asking, or trying to, we're going to award prizes, cash prizes to the departments. All of them will get something. And so to raise that money, we're asking for sponsorships or ads, and that'll be on the back of the program. And we already have had pledges of $100 for one. We have one more $100 space available.
I'll take that.
Very good. All right, and it's large enough that you can put you know your little ad, you know,
phone number,
address, your business, like a business card. We have several $50 spots, and that's large enough for your phone number or email address, and then $20 spots with just your name. So we are asking for those donations, those sponsorships, and you can see me for that. So I think after that, I will get it back to Rob.
Very good. It's a very worthy cause. This money will go to the philosophy departments of these various schools and to hopefully go to some scholarships. Okay, so I want to mention we have a website, www.philosophersforum.org. So check that out. We have a lot of cool stuff on there. We have links to other philosophy groups. And you can sign up for our email list on that website. And please forward that the link on to family and friends you think that might be interested in philosophy. And also you can sign up for updates on Meeting versus Meetup. Who all has heard about us via Meetup? Okay, so several of you have been. Okay, that's great. We're also looking for someone to help us with AV needs, maybe someone that's really great at social media. Who here is fantastic at social media? Not me. I'm sure there's some young people here that are phenomenal in all aspects of social media. So if you are, we'd really like to get some help we could really use some fresh blood. So see me or one of the other board members here afterwards if you're interested. We would love to get someone that is savvy in that area because we want to improve in our social media. We want to eventually move forward on that. Okay, so our speaker tonight, he'll be talking for about 45 minutes, and we'll open it up to questions. And one last thing before I introduce our speaker, please turn off your cell phones and put them on vibrate mode at this time. Now I'd like to introduce our speaker. We're very privileged to have Dr. Gerald Kasanov with us tonight. Dr. Kasanov is the acting chair of the Rehabilitation Counseling Program, UT Southwestern, and the assistant director of Clinical Ethics in Medicine course at UT Southwestern Medical School as well. In addition, he is a forensic consultant regarding loss of earnings capacity. He has a BA from Pomona College, that's in Southern California, right? Majored in philosophy. He 4 years playing football in college, so you know this guy's in pretty good shape. Were you NFL Hall of Fame? No, not quite there.
We're NCAA level three.
So what position did you play?
I was a corner and defensive back.
Corner and defensive back. Okay.
You have a knee injury.
Okay, because the Cowboys could use some help. But anyway, he also has an MA and a PhD in philosophy at Vanderbilt University. He's taught for 2 years at philosophy at Furman University, and 1 year as a Loos Fellow teaching in Taiwan, teaching Western philosophy.
You have to spell Loos. L-U-C-E, not L-O-S-E. Sorry.
Was that thing turned off?
Maybe I turned it off. Okay, pardon me. He has a Master of Science in Rehabilitation Counseling and a PhD in Clinical Psychology at UT Southwestern Graduate School of Biomedical Service Sciences.
It's just turning off.
Sorry about that. Normally, we like our speakers to have 3 PhDs. This speaker has 2 PhDs. We still are very thrilled to have him speak with us tonight. So, licensed psychologist, certified rehabilitation counselor. We got to get
new batteries.
He'll be speaking this evening on that. My mom always said I had a big voice, big mouth. So. Continue that. He'll be speaking this evening on the natural basis for an ethic of care. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Gerald Kasanov.
Is this thing need to be turned on or anything?
Not here. It's on there.
Okay. Well, yeah. I've been teaching ethics and things for a while. And one of the things I do at Southwestern, I teach the history and systems course in psychology, which is a lot of fun. And we can talk more about things like that. Recently, I got introduced to a guy named Stuart Hameroff. All of you need to track him down. He's an anesthesiologist at University of Arizona, and he has a quantum theory of consciousness. It's really wonderful that consciousness arises at the quantum level and proceeds at the classical level under appropriate circumstances. He came to that totally from the medical side. He never had a background in psychology or philosophy or anything, so he's a great guy. So there's fun stuff going on in the medical school. That was done by the Department of Psychoneuroendocrinology, and it's dealing with the interface now. We're getting down to where the biology happens of the mind and the body. It's just really exciting. May not happen in my lifetime, but it will in those of my students. I want this to be useful to you. I haven't given a formal philosophy talk outside the medical school for a while, and I don't want it to be a waste of your time. I need to acknowledge a couple things. Part of the motivation of this goes all the way back to when I was at Pomona College, and the senior seminar course had to do with Plato's Theaetetus and the issue of true belief and what does knowledge consist of, and I still remember that stuff. It's amazing. And then the other question was, the second half of the course was dealt with Kant, and what is the right thing to do? And Kant's famous phrase, the only thing that's good is a good will. And to me, the fundamental question of ethics is not, what is the right thing to do? It's, why be ethical? Why bother with it? You know, that if you don't get grabbed by that, you know, if you don't deal with that, then all the other stuff is just a bunch of talk. Well, you'd be more interested in who was in that class. In that class with me was this little you know, 4'8" woman who was just dynamite, and her name is Linda Rosen. And she went on to become Linda Rosen Obst, and she wrote for the Rolling Stone, and she produced the movie Contact, if you saw that. And she became a major, you know, Hollywood producer, and just a great story. But she was a philosophy major, Pomona, so that's the kind of philosophy majors turned out. And my major faculty person there was a guy named Fred Sontag. And if you ever get a chance, look at some of his books on Kierkegaard, and he really struggled with issues of belief. And he said he believed in God because Kierkegaard believed in God because Jesus believed in God. So that was the progression. The other person I want to acknowledge is someone who was really wonderful at Vanderbilt. There was a man named John Compton there. And he had an incredible legacy. His father was the Nobel Prize winner for inventing the Compton effect, discovering the Compton effect in physics. And John Compton became a philosopher and taught at Vanderbilt for many years. And he was just the archetypal gentleman philosopher. He was a really great guy. He did not like Heidegger, though, so we had our arguments. He was a Husserlian. And he kept warning me, if you keep reading Heidegger, you're going to become a psychologist. And you know, he was right. So I have to give him his props for that. Unfortunately, he died just this last year. But he was a wonderful, wonderful man. And he served on my dissertation committee, even though he had great reservations about it. So why bother with ethics? Why should we care? Well, the first answer is the easy one, right? If God exists, then Moses is right that we have the Ten Commandments, and if we don't do the right thing, what will happen to us? Go to hell. That's real simple, okay? So the religious argument about being ethical is a pretty powerful one. What's the problem with it? Well, does God exist, and does God exist in that form? And is that what we're really faced with, okay? So that's real problematic. And everybody here, I mean, I don't think you'd be here if you had really strong fundamental Christian beliefs. Unless you had some kind of weird, you know, masochism. And there's probably something about masochism here anyhow, just to come here tonight. But anyway, if we're not going to do the, what's the other basis? I mean, this is the standard talk in an ethics lecture for undergraduates and even for first-year medical students who probably never had an ethics course. Okay, if we don't do a religious basis, if that's not compelling, and especially post-Nietzsche, then what do we do? Okay, well, the ideal has always been in philosophy is to do what? Is to find a rational basis for ethics. And I love Kant, and I struggled with Kant for years. Kant was always very important to me. I always sort of dismissed Hume. You know, I saw Hume as the person who awoke Kant from his dogmatic slumbers, but Hume was an easy out, because Hume didn't really grapple with the kind of forceful, we've got to come up with a strong argument here. I mean, Hume was the one who argued there's no way to derive an ought from an is. Now, amazingly, I don't know what's going on campuses now, but back when I was a graduate student in philosophy at Vanderbilt, I had fellow students who were struggling with that and who were really trying to come up with, you know, an ethical logic so that you could actually derive an ought from an is. And I really respected them. I thought they were nuts, but I respected them. And so I always thought that the Kantian, you know, the moral imperative was the best we could do. But the problem again for me is it's not, well, there's two problems. One problem is what? Is that when you have fundamental categorical imperatives that are in conflict, there's no resolution of it. And that can happen. You know, the standard joke is, you know, somebody comes to your house and they beat on the door and they're scared. They say, let me in, somebody's trying to kill me. So you let them in and they go hide under your bed. And the next person comes up and has got this crazy look in their eyes and they've got an axe with blood dripping off it. And they said, did somebody just come in here?
Yeah.
Well, you have to make a choice. You know, what's going to be your overriding principle? Is it going to be not to lie, or is it going to be a concern for beneficence? You know, and so when there's a conflict of fundamental moral principles, justice, beneficence, there's no adjudication of that within the system. That's one thing. And then the other thing is why be moral? That's still, there's no answer to that. Somehow, and maybe that's somewhat our prejudice to those of us that are interested in philosophy, is that we think the rational is being a good thing. Well, take a look at the world around us. Most of the world doesn't really function that way, or they don't find that very compelling. So I don't think that's a very good basis for ethics. It's not enough.
Now, what was always been appealing is some kind of natural basis for ethics.
Well, what's the problem with that? Well, naturally, human beings do what Cain and Abel did. You know, we kill each other. We do all kinds of terrible things to each other, and it's natural, unless you want to argue, you know, von Däniken and some people came from another planet and caused us to do bad things, or, you know, you go back to the original sin kind of argument. That's not my interpretation of what went on in the Garden of Eden. So naturalism is very appealing, and it's deriving an ought from an is, but I never found a way for it to work. So that was always appealing, but it never seemed to work. If you look historically, the people that argued for a kind of naturalism ethics, such as, to some extent, I think Aristotle did. Now, Plato is more problematic, and again, I was more Platonic when I was younger, and less Aristotelian, more Kantian than Humean, and now, I mean, it's interesting how that's evolved for me. But definitely with Hume, I wasn't interested. And what do we say about Hume? What do we say about Hume's ethics? He gets called a sentimentalist. What a put-down. What a pejorative thing to say somebody. Their ethical theory is sentimentalism. I mean, Kant has real ethics, you know. This is what you ought to do, you know. Act on that principle that, you know, can be a universal law. All right, that sounds great, you know. Sentimentalism, what is that? And then another thing that happened to Vanderbilt, there were some interesting characters there. Clement Dorr, who was a chain smoker and who was a fallen Christian and was always trying to prove or disprove the existence of God. And so the epistemology class we studied, Alvin Plantinga's book, God and Other Minds. We didn't study epistemology, we studied Plantinga. That was crazy. But then Robert Amon, who was a genius, who taught a course on Shaler, on formalism in ethics and a non-formal ethics of values. And I took that course, and I thought I would be real excited by it. And, you know, again, I was still early 20s, and other things got in the way, like, you know, women and alcohol and sports and so on and so forth. So I didn't put enough time into it, and I've only come back around to appreciating Shaler. I think Shaler is one of the great thinkers of the 20th century, and he doesn't get enough credit. I mean, he moved... On his own, he struggled with issues around his beliefs and Christianity and moved to a kind of philosophical anthropology that was really powerful and very much caring about people and wanting good for people, but wandering away from the more traditional religious orientation. And so that always had some appeal to me. The idea of deriving ethics from a more natural experience, but I didn't know how to deal with it. And there's a book that I would recommend to all of you. It's big and fat, but it's by a guy named Ian McGilchrist, who is a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist, British neuroscientist psychiatrist. It came out in 2010, and so it's not that old. It's called The Master and His Emissary, and it's based on a parable that Nietzsche told about a master who was a benevolent master that ran this kingdom. And he was so big that he had different emissaries that would go out and carry out his will and check on them and come back and report to him. Well, he ran it very benevolently but rather loosely. And as long as his emissaries were okay, then it functioned well. But one of them sees potential there, a way to take over. And so he moves in and takes over for the master. And that's his story about the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, or about the dominant and non-dominant hemisphere, is that the non-dominant hemisphere is actually the master. And the whole first part of the book talks about what we now know, not just from experiments of nature, but also from MRIs, PETs, and we can study people's brains now while they're working. And we can see which part of the brain is active when certain things are going on. We also have a lot of evidence now for people with strokes and who have only half of their brain working. We also know how to produce artificial kind of strokes, and we can induce inactivity in one hemisphere and leave the other one active. And his overall thesis is that our non-dominant, which for most of us is our right hemisphere, is our most important hemisphere, but that the relationship between the two is very fragile, and at times one has been over the other. That prior to the Greeks, the argument is that it was primarily the non-dominant hemisphere. The part of the genius, the breakthrough of the Greek civilization was a discovery or an acknowledgement or a celebration of the left hemisphere too, and it was a period of balance. And then he goes back through history and looks at different epochs to look at what happens. But the key for this argument is that he produces a lot of evidence. Again, you know, you don't have to believe me, you can read it, that the stuff, that the beginnings of ethics are in the non-dominant hemisphere. And that's real important to me, because I'm not a very good analytic philosopher. I'm not very good at analysis. And all of that is after the fact. And you know, we can argue till the cows come home about what's the most important. But our fundamental experience of reality is through our non-dominant hemisphere. And that is how we are primarily engaged with things. And this is what, you know, we can, you know, argue about Heidegger too and his problems with his political stupidity and so on. But that Heidegger, his main attempt was to give voice to the experience of the non-dominant hemisphere. And that's what being in the world is all about, is that we do not exist in the way Descartes said. Descartes gave us already the world fragmented. You know, Descartes is the problem of Humpty Dumpty. Once you fall off the wall, you can't put it back together again. Or another way I talk about Descartes. Descartes painted himself in a corner, and he never got out. Well, Wittgenstein, Heidegger, and Dewey all dealt with the issue of certainty and the fact, the likelihood that we do not have certainty. We cannot have certainty, and that the best we can have is some kind of, you know, justified belief system. And I'd always resisted going from Hume, because the next step from Hume was Saniana and skepticism and animal faith, and that always seemed problematic. Now, I had a good friend at Vanderbilt who's a much more famous philosopher than I am, sorry, John Stuart, if you ever get a chance to read any of his stuff, S-T-U-H-R. He's like a endowed professor at Emory. And one time he actually returned to Vanderbilt to be chair, which is a great thing to be able to go back to your university and be the chair there. And he was way beyond me in graduate school, because he grew up, his mother had a PhD in philosophy. And so he'd already dealt with all this stuff that I was struggling with in terms of religion and what's right and who's right and so on. And he'd already made the move to Saniana and to Dewey, and that's the way it goes, I think, ultimately. But the beautiful thing is, I think, that I see a fundamental congruence between what Heidegger and Wittgenstein and Dewey were all doing in the early parts of the 20th century, and the way in which they said basically certainty is a futile quest, that we do not, that's not an option, it's not going to happen. I mean, Wittgenstein did the argument most elegantly in the Tractatus. Bertrand Russell, unfortunately, didn't understand it, and Wittgenstein threatened to pull the book off the press, off the rack, because of the foreword he felt by Bertrand Russell was a total misunderstanding. But that the best we can do, that what we have, and McGilchrist lays this out really well, is that the dominant hemisphere, what we do representationally, what we do explicitly, is we take up what's given to us through our immediate experience of things, and we representationalize it, and we conceptualize it. And that's where the quest for certainty and all that comes in with. But it's already stuff that we already have received. And so we have a more basic experience of things, but it's really hard to get to that. And especially for us philosophers, because the moment we start talking about it, we're over in the dominant hemisphere. And that's why the dominant hemisphere was always trying to take over, because that's the way it sees things. And there's good stuff, concerns about, you know, how we've moved from a certain way of being in the world to very much an exploitational view about the world. It's very consistent with concerns about environmentalism and things like that. And, you know, again, we can go any of those directions you want to go or not go. All right. So that has appealed to me, that it appeared, at first I was resistant to that. It's just like, there's evidence of what? There's evidence that when we decide something explicitly, we've already decided it at an unconscious level, that our thinking happens there, but it's not representational. The best I can do is I love to watch my cats. And the way they experience the world is they're just totally engaged in it. They don't have the step back quality that we have. Right? And I think the closest we come to that is if we go to a movie that we really get caught up in, we don't sit there thinking, well, this is just a movie, and this is just a piece of celluloid that's going in front of a film, or it's a DVD, or whatever. No, we're totally engaged in it, and we cry, and we have feelings, and all that. That's all our primary experience of reality. But we have that capacity to step back, and it's very powerful. I mean, it's not a negation of it, but it can, at times, appear to take that over. But the attempt to try to stay with what our immediate experience of things, this is very, very difficult. And again, like things like music probably do that better than more explicit kinds of discussions in language, because again, to put it into language, and Heidegger, some of his convolutions in language have to do with his attempt to, you know, as people like to say, F the ineffable or whatever, you know, to talk about what happens before we talk about stuff. Non-representational thought. And again, I think we all do that. It's when we're totally engaged in whatever we're doing and we're not thinking about it, we are thinking it. And then we can always step back and think about it. I mean, it's something when I supervise students learning how to be psychotherapists, I say, what you have to do as a psychotherapist, you have to do both of those things. You have to be totally in the moment with your client, and part of you has to be standing back and watching what's happening and observing the whole thing too, so that you can be useful to point out things to them. Because if you're just totally engaged in it with them, you're just like anybody else in their life, and they're not going to make any progress. Okay, so it appears that morality or moral sense is just that it begins as a feeling that we have. And we could talk about this from a Humean perspective or from McGilchrist talks about it from a neuroscience perspective. Another thing that I've always been unhappy with is that, you know, Kohlberg has always been such a paragon of ethics. You know, this is ethical development. Now, I don't think that's what Kohlberg's about at all. Kohlberg is about the development of ethical reasoning, and that's fine. And I think there's a place for that. But Kohlberg does not connect with where ethics comes from more fundamentally, and I think that's where the complementarity or the completion of it is, through the notion of the feeling of things. Now, and ultimately, a lot of you won't be satisfied where I'm going, because I'm not going to leave you with a knockdown, drag-out argument. I'm not going to get from is to ought. I'm going to get from is to this is probably what we should do. Okay, it's a weak obligation, not a strong one. I'm very influenced by Heidegger, and again, we can talk about that. My dissertation in philosophy was on metaphor, and I developed a theory of metaphor out of Heidegger's development of language, and I did this in 1977. I got 20, you know, nobody cares, but I did this before Lakoff and Johnson came out with their book, Metaphors We Live By. But I knew Mark Johnson well. When I was at SIU, he was there. And Lakoff is spectacular. I mean, have you ever heard him talk politically? He's wonderful. The way he says that, you know, the way we need to be able to talk to, he's very, very much a liberal in how we need to talk to conservatives in order to get our point across. But the whole issue of metaphor has always been critical for me, I found in Heidegger a resource for making sense of metaphor in a different way than had been traditionally done. So I wrote my dissertation largely about Heidegger. Heidegger's always been part of my concerns. And so I'm real familiar with Heidegger's analysis of Dasein, of human being, and his statement that the meaning of human being is care. And again, we can have a lot of discussion about that. The question is the word being used as a homonym? If you remember with Aristotle argued that various discussions of the word being were actually homonyms, that the word was used in different ways and it meant really different things, even though it sounded the same. But I think Heidegger is spot on when he says that our fundamental nature is care. We are very unusual creatures. The world matters to us. If you don't like the word care, because care does have a range. I can say, you know, I don't care anymore. Even to say you don't care anymore means you do care, but there is a range of care, and we care about some things to a greater degree than other things. I don't care as much about this floor as long as it doesn't give way under my feet. You know, the color doesn't thrill me, but I don't have to live here, so, you know, I don't care that much about the carpet as long as I'm not going to get sick and whatever. But it's still an element of care, because why? Because I have a name for this. The carpet has its name, and I identify it. I can pick it out in here from the other things in here. That's the basic level of care. If you don't like the word care, you can use the word value. We value things. We evaluate them. And we, another way of saying it, we inhabit a realm of meaning, a world in which things matter to us. They matter to a lesser degree, greater degree. Unfortunately, we use the word care often to mean like a synonym for affection or love or something like that. And that's one extreme of care. But at a basic level, what is definitive about us is we care about stuff. And again, I know that cats and dogs, I mean, I love other mammals, and I'm not going to say they don't care. They clearly do care, but they seem to be limited to caring about their immediate environment. I have no sense that my cats have angst about, you know, the greenhouse effect or about any of that stuff. I mean, they're just concerned if there aren't any more birds coming in the backyard that they can watch. Okay? I don't, you know, while sometimes dogs will howl at the moon, I don't have any sense that they wonder what life is like on the moon or want to go there. I mean, we are this amazing creature that wants to know where things are, what it's like out there, and we try to travel, and we want to know what life was like at the beginning of things. And another dimension of this is, you know, I'm not much of a physicist, but I do some reading on that, and it has to do with the quantum theory of consciousness and stuff, but it also has to do with the mind-body problem, and where is mind real, and so on and so forth. And I use a book, and I recommend it to you, a guy by the name of Willichek. I'm not sure if I pronounced it right, but he was won the Nobel Prize for Physics in the early 2000s, and his book is called The Lightness of Being. And part of that is wonderful because it's a play on the guy who wrote the book and the movie The Incredible Lightness of Being, which is a spectacular literary work. But what he argues is that ultimately what the universe consists of is not matter, but it's energy, and that matter emerges from energy. And if there truly was a Big Bang, guess what? We are all realizations of that. We have all the same principles within us that were there then. And you can, you know, you don't have to go really super weird with that. But, if there was such a thing and this is all developed, then it had to be there at the beginning in some form. And Buddhists would love that anyhow, because their argument of change is that arguments about change are all illusory, that you know, if it's there in the first place, then it's never really changed, you know, so on and so forth. But anyway, what that argument says is that it makes some sense, then, of our concern about the rest of the environment, because we have that within us. But it also is a strong argument for what? How fundamentally interconnected everything is. And we're learning that. That was the first major breakthrough of environmentalism, was to understand that you couldn't understand what was going on with one species or with one plant life without understanding the larger ecosystem. And there's just a great story recently about wolves, that they had been hunted down from one area in northern Canada or whatever, and because the wolves were hunted, then the deer and the moose were no longer so afraid, so they would come down more into the open areas, and they ate more of the vegetation, they killed the young trees, they killed the grass, so there was erosion, the erosion led to kill, you know, on and on and on. All these things happened because the wolves weren't around anymore, and the way that they began to fix it was to reintroduce some wolves. You had to look at the bigger picture. And again, if you read McGilchrist, his argument is that the power of our left brain is that it analyzes, and it breaks things down into pieces. The ultimate importance of the right brain is the right brain can then re-accept that, though, and reintegrate it and revision it. I mean, that's always the problem with Humpty Dumpty, I think, of the analytic tradition, is we take stuff, and this happens in psychology. You know, and when I learned how to do assessment in psychology, you want to know what's going on with somebody? You give them an IQ test, you give them an achievement test, you give them a personality test, you give them an interest test. Then what do you have? You have different pieces of a person. People who write really good assessments, who do a good job of assessment, they're able to take that and put that back in, and you've got a person again. And otherwise, you just have a listing of scores and a scattered, and the person has fallen apart. And again, that is the power, it appears, of the non-dominant hemisphere. While it is the immediate fodder for the left hemisphere, the dominant hemisphere, that it is the one that can then retake up what was given, what's done by the left hemisphere and put things together. So the short argument is that we care about stuff. That's our nature. All right? It's a soft argument about obligation. Okay? We care. Now, clearly, people can go a lot of different directions with that. I mean, if Hitler was human, then he was a really bad example of caring. He cared about some things, didn't care about a lot of things. I think he was really evil. I think the problem of evil is always a difficult one, especially, you know, if you don't believe in some kind of embodiment of the devil. But there clearly have been really bad stuff. So you have to allow for that. Things can go wrong. There's no guarantee, even though our sense of connection, even though our care about others, especially, you know, we seem to have the most connection with other people. Our chemistry, we respond most to human faces and things like that. That things can go awry. And I think the developmental aspect here, and I think this is where, you know, things we've learned through psychology, is how if people are treated badly, some of them survive that, but a lot of them don't. And that their sense of care for anybody else gets beaten out of them. You wouldn't believe the terrible stuff I read about, you know, or hear about from clients about what's happened to them when they were children and so on. Just, it's really awful what we can do to each other. I don't know if you ever read any Annie Dillard, who wrote Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. She's a naturalist that lived out in the wild and wrote about her experiences. And she's reassuring because she says it's just not humans that do terrible stuff. Birds got to fly, fish got to swim, and insects have to do one terrible thing after another to each other. So, yeah, that clearly there's bad stuff that seems to be bred into them. But, you know, again, we tend not to judge our animals as that they do more wrong or whatever. We hold humans to a different standard, and I think the level of care is different than the level of awareness. So the way I argue is that the nature of ethics is that it fundamentally is part of us, that we care, that things matter to us. Now, we have to evaluate them. We make a hierarchy. We sort out value. That's fine. The other part of it is that we are fundamentally interconnected with everything. And ultimately, I don't believe in altruism, because I believe that anything I do has an effect for me. And one of the things I do at the medical school now, what I do clinically more than anything, is I evaluate people that want to be living kidney donors. And what am I trying to do? Figure out, one, that they understand what they're at risk for happening. Nobody's forcing them. No subtle or overt coercion. And three, that they're not crazy, or they're not being, you know, misguided in some way or another. So, again, things can go awry. But I don't think somebody has to be an altruistic donor if they're not donating to family. Everybody gets something out of everything that happens. It doesn't have to be to the same extent or the same level. And there's nothing wrong about that. The key is enlightened self-interest. And I think that's where the importance of Kant and Kohlberg comes back in, is that what we have to do is nurture this real incipient sense of care. It's there. But we help people develop their moral reasoning. And you, for Kohlberg, what do? You go through pre-conventional, which is what? Is, you know, you're good because you're going to get punished. You're going to get spanked if you're not good. And then you learn to adopt conventional morality, which is you see how it's going to advance yourself if you follow the rules and you can make it work for you. And then if you go far enough, you can achieve post-conventional morality. And I think that... And it's no mistake that people point out that this follows Piagetian conceptual development. And I think that's what it is. And I think that's where the left brain, that's where the reason comes in, is in a fuller expression of our, what's an innate sense of care and connection with things. And that to achieve the post-conventional is to understand the fundamental interconnectedness of stuff. Does that lead to a hard obligation? No. I mean, there's no absolute punishment that will come to anybody. You know, there's the legal consequences of what you do. But, you know, if you really work to have an awareness of things, of how things are interconnected, then I think that does give a guide to, you know, how one is going to behave. And again, I don't think the categorical imperative is worthless. I think it's probably a good basis for communication across cultures until we can all get to the point where we're more receptive of each other and we're not immediately condemning other people because they don't think exactly like we do, that it provides some common ground. But I think, you know, where we ultimately have to go is a more developed sense of our nature as caring individuals, as a caring species, and a caring species that has the capacity for understanding the whole system. Another way of talking about it is, it's really spooky, but the kind of creature we are, the size we are, we seem to be halfway in between. We seem to be about halfway between the infinitesimally small and the infinitely large. It's called the event horizon scale. And again, you can get real mystical and weird about that if you want to, but there does seem to be something about that. And an incredible, the similarity between how the infinitesimally small and the infinitely large are structured and where we fall in that process and our awareness of that. So, final conclusion, our ethical feeling and care about each other and things is fragile. It develops when nurtured and encouraged. It can be extinguished. Ethical reasoning, as Kohlberg first laid it out, appears to advance from pre-conventional to conventional, post-conventional. What's interesting, I don't know if Kohlberg ever acknowledges this, I don't know if you know about Nietzsche's stages. What were Nietzsche's stages? Nietzsche's stages of ethical development were the camel, the lion, and the child. And we go through this camel phase, which is the assumption of the burdens of our tradition, and then we go through, like adolescence, we go through a breakthrough phase where we throw off all the traditions. But the point is not to get where everything is permitted. Nietzsche never said that. He said nothing is forbidden. That's the conclusion of the end of the judge, you know, theistic guy in the sky that controls everything. But to then live as a child does in terms of wonder and delight, which seems to be very parallel to pre-conventional, conventional, post-conventional. And I also need to give some props to Carol Gilligan. I think she was real important, at least in my development, of understanding that, you know, Kohlberg got part of it right, but he lacked that connectedness of things. And that if you don't want to call it, deal with an ethics of care, another name for it is connectionism, but the importance of an acknowledgement of the context and the connection for how we make decisions, and that justice and autonomy and beneficence and non-maleficence all happen within a context, that they do not stand outside of a context, which is often what people want to make them do. Anyway, how are we doing time-wise?
Okay.
Well, I'm pretty much done, unless whatever you want to talk about. Yeah,
okay. Thank you.
That was great.
Yeah, well,
I'm glad they serve alcohol on your chair, so that's good.
We don't have that.
In
my view,
it doesn't work.
All philosophical speculation about morality is moot. I think science, evolutionary science, gives us the answer to why we're moral and why we care. Okay. And the answer is morality and caring for one another is an evolutionary adaptation. We care because it works. We care because it works and it has evolved. We're the product of 6 million years of evolution. We now sit here as the product of I think we've all, mankind has always been moral to one extent or another, even prehistorical man. Modern man's about 100,000 years old. But the point I'm getting at is that I think evolutionary science has given us the answer to the question about what is moral. And what is moral is anything that enhances well-being. And the reason that we're moral is because it works and because morality and caring for one another is mutually beneficial. And it seems to me that that's really powerful. Hume argued that science has nothing to say about morality. Well, he's wrong. With the advent of evolutionary theory, especially in the last 45 years, I would argue, I think evolution teaches us everything that we need to understand about where morality came from.
Just my...
Yeah, I think that's part of it. There's an interesting argument. The discussion is morality fundamentally an issue of utility or not? And it appears to transcend that, though. But that's my perspective, and that Shaler argues that too. You can either argue that the higher values are in service of the lower values, like the pyramid that people, the Shaler made, is at the top you have the whole, and at the bottom you have utility. And Shaler argues that utility is in service of the other. I mean, we do seem weird in that we transcend utility. It isn't just utility that matters to us. Utility is important. And it certainly had to survive it. But I would go even stronger back to the, you know, whatever was there at the Big Bang, you know, those principles come through us in our sense, our concern for the well-being is also for the well-being of the whole universe, amazingly. And that's implicit in the process. And so again, I understand. And one of my favorite things that I ever went to was Defending the Caveman. Did you ever see that? A one-man show. He was good. I got dragged to that kicking and screaming, you know. And it's a great one-man show. And he talks about millions of years of evolution. We did what? We were hunters and gatherers, you know. And this is something I teach when I talk about work and the evolution of being humans. You know, when did we start having farming and domestication of animals? Oh, about 10,000 years ago. I mean, it's so recent. And when did we have the Industrial Revolution? Oh, about 300 years ago. We have in no way been able to adapt to the changes we have affected in the world around us. And we're still living out, you know, who we were for millions of years. And you know, hopefully we'll survive. But certainly the universe will survive us if we don't survive.
Other questions? Well, I had one. Could you speak as a philosopher and an ethicist at a university at Southwest Medical School? I'd like to get your thoughts on assisted suicide and the approach you see in the United States versus what I perceive to be as a more enlightened approach in Europe.
That's a big question. I think suicide is a rational choice. That's a real, that human beings have the right to kill themselves. You shouldn't do it, though, under bad circumstances. Unfortunately, a lot of times people kill themselves when they're in a lot of pain, and you need to make sure you've exhausted options. Or, you know, as we were talking beforehand, of one woman I worked with who shot herself, then didn't manage to kill herself, but left herself with some permanent brain damage. But her world was closing in on her. And if she had been able to get through a few hours, she could have made some changes in her life and would have been able to go on. She survived and she still went on, but with impairments that were really bad. So I think it's especially, you know, if I wanted to kill myself, what would I do? I would say to everybody, hey, this weekend I'm just stressed out. I'm going to go out and spend a few days in the wilderness. You can go out and you kill yourself and nobody knows about it. They're not going to find it. Anytime someone gives you the opportunity to discover them, that means they don't want to kill themselves. And so I think we have a right to intervene whenever we come upon something like that, because people haven't been serious about it. But otherwise, I think we have the right to make that choice, but you know, we can argue about that.
Very good.
You have to be careful about saying anything positive about Europe here, especially about France.
I was wanting to divide your caring into intellectual curiosity versus ethical empathy for other people's suffering.
Well, that's where it starts out. It starts out with the empathy of suffering, but our caring goes beyond that, beyond humans. I mean, that part of that is just saying how this seems to be an essential part of who we are. Okay.
Well, in sort of society's race at the bottom, where sometimes it's hard to tell whether there's
lower standards of moral and ethical empathy for other people's feelings given how some people behave towards each other, versus whether there's a lack of intellectual curiosity if you look at what's on TV and things like that. It would seem to me that maybe, in terms of evolution and what society does to you, that perhaps it's easier to beat out of you empathy for the feelings of others than it is to beat out of you entirely, at least, intellectual curiosity. Because if you beat intellectual curiosity out of people entirely, the consequences for themselves is actually really pretty bad frequently. Whereas if you beat out of them caring about other people, unless you beat it out of them too much, like where they say, well,
I don't care how many shoulders, and you kind of ignore how everybody else feels about that, where they're going to jump on you and kill you. It seems to me that the consequences of ignoring your feelings for others might be less than
ignoring intellectual curiosity. I'm wondering how you feel about that.
That may be true. Interesting to change your question, how do I feel about that? Because, you know, often we say feel, and we would say, what do people think about that, or whatever, we have a bad, that we're sort of, one of the things I'm thinking about when you're saying that is one of my favorite lines from one of the songs in Hair, how can people be so heartless, especially people who care about strangers, who care about evil and social injustice. I mean, we can have this incredible disjunct between, you know, immediate caring and, you know, more intellectual. I think the intellectual one is parasitic or is derivative or based on the other one, but at some point it can survive, it can take on a life of its own, and that's again would be Gilfrith's argument that the left hemisphere tries to take over and turn ethics totally into utilitarianism and what's useful for me, and maybe I'll be concerned about the big picture, but only as it really advances my concerns, as opposed to, you know, going all the way back to my connection and my care about things at a more basic level. I don't know if that answers, but that's a response.
I was struck by the fact that many cultures, going back for many centuries,
like a very big deal out of what we call the Golden Rule.
Yeah.
And that seems to be related to what you're talking about, is caring. And it seems to provide something closer to an ethical absolute, if you will. I don't know that it's generally claimed to be any kind of supernatural basis, if there is any such thing, but a purely natural recognition of what works well in human relationships within all sorts of societies.
Now, McGilchrist argues that we have evidence, again, with the way the brain operates, that we have that kind of feeling for others and wanting good for them. The justice also begins as a feeling, that kind of thing. So that would be, what's interesting is people say that Kant's categorical imperative is sort of the negative statement of the Golden Rule, and that's part of its power. You know, Kant's, it's not do unto others, don't do anything to other people that you wouldn't want done to you. So the categorical imperative doesn't mean you have to be nice, it just means don't be mean to other people and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think there is power in the, you know, the way our more intellectual representation of those feelings can help us bridge across societal gaps. You know, one of the things that's powerful to me is that the four most noble truths of Buddhism are very much what Jesus argued. You know, there's suffering as a cause. The cause of suffering is desire, which in our culture in the West, we call that, you know, original sin, concupiscence, and stuff like that. And there is a solution to that. Now, it's really incredibly similar. So again, I think that's indications that there is similarity across cultures, but it's not the only way to go. I mean, within Chinese society, you also have incredible, terrible things happen there, or Japan, and certainly we've done terrible things, and so on and so forth. So it's no getting, what's not appealing about my position is there's no guarantee that things are going to turn out right. But on the other hand, with, you know, Kantian morality, there's certainly no guarantee things are going to come out right either. You know, that people are going to choose to be rational, and on the basis of the rationality, they're going to choose to do the good. Yeah.
Okay, question here. I'm sorry, I have mics out. Sure. You can speak up.
Okay. So, I don't know, most of the people you're talking about have only taken one philosophy class ever in my life. So have no idea why I'm talking.
Well, actually, I should apologize for having taken too many philosophy courses.
But actually, I can't talk about what 100 people have said in the past, because I don't know what they said. But one thing that was interesting, because you touched upon that we are in between small and large, which is the same as us being between classical and physical, or quantum physics. And I think ethics is constant data, and that we're always making decisions on the fly, and how being artists. So if you're trying to identify where ethics is in the brain, isn't that more of the classical physics where you're trying to locate, and then the quantum physics is something that's in constant different states that's always changing based
upon... But you don't know what things are at the quantum state. Anytime you measure them, you take them out of the quantum state and put it in the classical state.
We live
the quantum state, yeah.
I don't have an argument.
But our awareness of it is to transform it into the Schrodinger cat thing.
Again. Okay, so I'll just circle around. So what I've written down, if ethics is just a set of data, because I think there's a whole bunch of data that's going into our decisions constantly, of what's going to be beneficial to us, what's beneficial to somebody else. I think this is just constant. The ethical, if ethics is just one set of data that's going into like a quantum part of it and it's constantly changing, wouldn't the less domicile be gathering data that gets shoved over to the right side that has a metric system that has been developed based upon what we value, and what we value is based upon how we're raised, our cultural experiences, and everything. So it's just a thought that I was writing down, that it seems almost a problem to try to say it's one side of the brain or the other. That's like classical physics of trying to locate something. The mystery of quantum physics is that it's always changing states, which I think that we are constantly doing with a bunch of different data sets, ethics being one set of data that constantly goes in.
But my understanding, and again, I'm not that good at what I know about quantum mechanics is more from Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff, but that what we become aware of is those quantum states that move to a classical level. And what's amazing, though, is it appears that can then go back and inform what happens at the more fundamental level, the preconceptual level. That there's a back and forth there. Now, the best way I can say it is that, like somebody who gets addicted to a substance, their limbic system has reworked their brain so it's overrun the frontal cortex, and the frontal cortex is not having much input over how the limbic system is working. But what's possible is for people through treatment to get to where their frontal cortex can have more say about that what the limbic system is doing, which functions in a much more immediate connected with stuff. Now, if there's quantum mechanics, it's operating in all parts of the brain, not just in one part or the other. But if you can then have an effect on the reinforcement process that occurs in the limbic system, even though you're not affecting it, as directly as you maybe would want to, like surgery would do or something like that, which would restructure it. But people are showing that there can be effective treatment at a more representational level that pervades back down to the more immediate level of our experience. And I think we're capable of that ethically. That we make early decisions, we make initial decisions and so on, but that over time, and that's all, otherwise why does it work to teach any people anything about ethics? Is that people appear to be capable of changing, and they change by becoming aware of how they think about things, and they change their script and their interpretation. So while in some ways the input is the same, maybe, or the input happens the same, how they process it gets modified.
Okay, we have time for two last questions, one right back here.
I'm not really sure I don't really have a question, but I'd like to get your comment. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay. I also have to warn you that a year ago I broke down and got hearing aids. And then 2 weeks ago, the left one went down. So it had to be shipped back to the right. So I have the right one.
It's going directly into the non-dominant here. One of the things that you discussed just a moment ago about suicide, and I believe you were saying that if a person really wants to commit suicide, they wouldn't want to be discovered or found. I heard something on the news today. I think the biggest mystery why most people in the world care today is this recent missing airline.
Yeah.
And it was commentary that why would someone choose to go to the most remotest part of the planet? And if indeed was this suicide or what, was this mechanical? What do you think? I mean, I don't know what do you think was going on here?
I don't know about that, but a lot of suicides are, they're very angry. So you're trying to do something. Somebody, and one of the commentators talked about this. They said, well, gee, they went off and they disappeared, so they didn't get any bang out of it. They said, no, of course there's been a bang out of it. People have been wondering about them for the last 2 weeks. You know, have you thought about other people, certain people, as much as you have about them over the last 2 weeks? Probably not. I mean, it's amazing, you know, whether it was intentional or not, how it persists. When people kill themselves where they're going to be found by family members or friends or whatever, that's a very, very terrible thing to do. It's very, very angry. And they know what they're doing when they do it. You know, they know the effect that that's going to have. They're punishing people for something. So if this was intentional, somebody was trying to punish them.
But they can't be found. I mean, it's like that was the
doesn't point. Matter.
Went to the most
what has this done to everybody, the families of the other people in there that were relatively innocent? They suffered immensely. They have had this incredible, if somebody did this intentionally, they've had it, and they would have been smart enough to know that if we go this, these people are going to suffer, you know, while they look for us. Really, really mean, terrible thing to do. But.
Thank you. Daniel, speak up, please.
My question is to the minister that, are we evolving out of caring? Because the maximum amount of people supposedly care for on a personal level is about 300. Society is growing. We don't live in small country anymore, a small group. So it seems like caring and ethic is being replaced by laws. So are we as a species evolving our ethic?
I don't think McGill Chris would argue we're at risk, because if the left hemisphere remains, it takes total dominance, we lose connection. The most important thing to learn in Texas is what? That if you want to change lanes, it has nothing to do with your turn indicator. It has to do with what? That you make eye contact with the other driver. And Texans are incredibly polite when you connect with them as a person. But if you don't have that personal connection, they'll run you down. You know? And so I think it can be lost. You know, and the relationship, it's always a great issue. I mean, there are things that are legal that aren't ethical, and there are things that are ethical and are not legal. And what do we do historically, though? We've always allowed ethics to trump what's legal. You know, Thoreau is the one that said, even though it's chauvinist, he said, if the laws of a country are unjust, the place for the just man is in prison. And that's the basis for civil disobedience. So, I think we're always at risk. I don't think that any of this stuff is a given. My hope is that if we do manage to destroy ourselves as a society and our Earth, at least there'll be enough of the universe left that it can keep on developing. Because I think I really do think the fundamental principles of the universe are basically benign, or this amazing stuff would not be here. But on the other hand, we can certainly mess it up. So, I think there's reason for concern.
Okay, very good. Last question for you.
Yeah, I'd like to say, thoroughly enjoyed the talk.
Okay. Fun for me.
I recently went to see the movie Divergent, which have you had a chance to see it yet?
No, never did.
I highly recommend it, especially for someone like you who is interested in so many of those issues that are addressed in there, which has to do with the balances of power and ethical decisions and the elements that come into play to throw issues lopsided and then helps to bring them back in. But the introduction of very strong drug is driven by the last part of it, which you say was a great difference. This is an area that I'm very concerned about, is the overuse of very strong drugs today. You hear about so many people using hormones at different levels that when withdrawals begin to take place, serious side effects happen that can actually imbalance the entire society and culture. How do you address that? How do you try to
balance? You know, medications have been used to invisibly control people. The big issue I still remember when I was working with adolescents more was we have this aversion to restraining people physically, but sometimes that's what they need. And physically restraining can allow people to process it in ways that just giving them a drug and numbing them out or making them into a zombie. And that's one of the Gilchrist models for what we have our risk of becoming, a bunch of those zombies. Is things without feeling, is that they're...
But what about learning the process of self-control?
Yeah, well,
doesn't that take that...
People are a little crazy. Well, where does the desire for control come from? I think it comes out of our fundamental anxiety in the face of death. I think Becker and others are right about that we, most of human society spends its time trying to divert itself from the fact that it's going to die. And that's part of the power of Heidegger, as Heidegger says, what do I know for sure about anybody in this room? I don't know what you're going to do in the next second. But I do know for sure you're going to die. And yet we spend most of our lives as if we're immortal. And the quest for power and control are all, I think, can be very much motivated by our anxiety in the face of our death. I mean, I'm very much with Kierkegaard and fear of Kremlin and sickness unto death. But that's the fundamental problem for humans is how do we deal with our own deathliness? And that's the whole story of Jesus, is that Jesus supposedly is a story of why the fact that we're dying is not a punishment from God that we did something bad, which is the way death has been interpreted for millennia for humans. That we must have done something bad because we're getting capital punishment. And to not see death as a punishment and to be able to live in the face of our own eventual death and to not waste ourselves in the pursuit of a lot of things that will distract us from that.
Let's give a round of applause for Dr.